If you bought an S&P 500 index fund today, I mean, conventional wisdom says you're playing it safe, right?
Oh, definitely. That's the classic advice.
Right. But looking at the 2025 financial data we're doing a deep dive into today, that quote unquote safe bet might actually be, well, one of the riskiest traps in the entire market.
It really is. The illusion of this permanently paved financial road is just fading fast.
Yeah.
For decades, the strategy was totally linear. You buy property in a major metropolitan hub, you dump your surplus cash into a broad U.S. index fund, and you just ignore it for 30 years.
Set it and forget it.
Exactly. And that worked beautifully when inflation was asleep and interest rates were at rock bottom.
But you step into the reality of 2025, and those conditions are completely gone. I mean, we
Yeah.
have the sticky inflation that just refuses to cool down,
Yeah, and it's super.
and interest rates that are acting like unpredictable weather systems. Suddenly, you have to actively pilot your portfolio rather than just, putting it on cruise control.
You really do.
So, welcome to the deep dive. Our mission today is to take a stack of highly relevant, up-to-the-minute investment analysis and audit it against your actual financial goals.
We're looking for actionable stuff here.
Exactly. We are hunting for the absolute most effective places to put your money right now, whether you are trying to build aggressive growth, generate steady income, or construct a bulletproof shield for the wealth you already have.
And we'll be breaking this down across five distinct pillars. So we're looking at real estate, equities, commodities, digital assets, and fixed income.
All the big ones.
Right. And the underlying theme across all of these is adaptation. Because sticking to a 2015 playbook in 2025 is just, it's a recipe for capital erosion.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the foundation. Because even with all the chaotic monetary policy out there, physical real estate remains the classic anchor for long-term wealth.
Absolutely. It's a tangible asset.
Right, but the map of where you actually plant that anchor has been entirely redrawn. It's like looking at a global monopoly board, but Boardwalk and Park Place are suddenly terrible investments.
Right, because the property taxes and carrying costs are just eating your returns alive.
Exactly. The real money has moved off the traditional board entirely.
You see that shift happening vividly in the U.S. market right now. The smart money is migrating away from expensive coastal city centers. We are seeing massive reallocations into places like Florida, Texas, and the Midwest.
Which makes sense.
It does. The mechanics driving this are simple. It's yield. When borrowing costs are elevated, you can't rely purely on the hope that a property's value will just magically jump 20% in a year.
Right, the speculative game is over.
Completely over. You need strong, reliable rental returns to cover your financing, and the math simply works better outside those traditional metropolitan bubbles.
That domestic shift definitely makes sense, but the international data is where things get truly wild. I mean, foreign governments are essentially rolling out red carpets woven out of tax breaks to attract capital.
Oh, heavily. Portugal and Greece are heavily incentivizing foreign buyers with these golden visa residency programs.
And those European markets are appealing because they combine relatively affordable entry prices with steadily growing rental yields.
Exactly. But if you want to understand where raw economic growth is colliding with real estate, you really have to look at Southeast Asia. Vietnam and Indonesia are just surging right now.
See, I always thought of emerging Asian markets as incredibly complex for an outsider to navigate. Like, if I buy a villa in Indonesia, aren't I taking on massive political and regulatory risk?
Well, this raises an important question. How do you actually time and validate an offshore move without getting burned?
Yeah, how do you do that?
You don't just blindly buy property because a country has a growing GDP. You have to look for the mechanical changes in their property laws. Vietnam, for instance, recently passed sweeping reforms, making it drastically easier and safer for foreign entities to hold property. When a government actively dismantles its own bureaucracy to welcome foreign dollars, that's when institutional capital floods in.
So that legislative change is your leading indicator.
There you go.
But we're also seeing a different kind of mechanical change in Europe, specifically in established markets like Germany and the Netherlands.
Right.
There's a sudden resurgence there that isn't about new laws, but rather a brutal collision of supply and demand.
Yeah, it's a perfect storm. Those countries are facing a severe urban housing shortage at the exact moment their interest rates have finally stabilized.
Which is crazy timing.
It is. When you have intense demand for housing, virtually zero new supply coming online because construction just totally slowed down during the rate hikes, and borrowing costs that are finally predictable property values have nowhere to go but up.
Then you look at the Middle East, and the data gets incredibly granular. It treats Saudi Arabia not as one market, but as this complex ecosystem of micro-markets.
Yeah, it's really nuanced.
It's fascinating how a single country offers entirely different investment profiles. I mean, you've got Riyadh, which is the bureaucratic and financial engine. That's your play if you want blue chip stability and corporate tenant demand.
Right, but then moving west, you have Jeddah. And the investment thesis there is purely logistical.
Okay, how so?
Well, it's experiencing a massive wave of infrastructure development to modernize its capacity as a premier Red Sea port.
Mm.
So you are literally investing in the flow of global trade.
Wow. And then there's NAOM, that massive futuristic mega city project. But what caught my eye isn't just NAOM itself, but Tabuk, the region right next to it.
Yes. Tabuk is so interesting.
It really is. Tabuk is essentially playing the role of the supply chain hub. It's the staging ground for this trillion-dollar vision next door.
And investing in Tabuk is a classic adjacent market strategy. The land inside a mega project is often priced at a massive premium. But the surrounding areas that have to house the workers, stage the materials, and provide all the logistical support, they see incredible secondary appreciation.
Now, you're probably listening to this thinking, well, this is great theory, but I don't have millions of dollars to buy a supply chain warehouse in Saudi Arabia or an apartment block in Greece.
Yeah, most people don't.
Right. And a decade ago, you'd be absolutely right to tune out here. Traditional real estate requires massive upfront capital and completely locks up all your liquidity.
Which naturally bridges us to the technological evolution of this anchor.
Okay, let's hear it.
How do you get exposure to that Greek apartment block or that Saudi logistical hub without putting down a massive cash deposit and, you know, dealing with a foreign property management company?
Sounds impossible.
The answer lies in digital assets. And to be very clear, we are not talking about speculative cryptocurrencies here. We are talking about tokenization.
Okay, let me make sure I'm breaking this down correctly. Tokenization is taking a physical, illiquid asset, like a commercial high-rise, and basically creating a digital Wikipedia page for it on a blockchain.
That's a great way to put it.
Right. So instead of one billionaire owning the whole building, thousands of people can own and edit a tiny line of code that represents one square foot of lobby space. And the ledger tracks who owns what instantly.
Exactly.
But how is that functionally different from me just opening a brokerage account and buying shares in a traditional real estate investment trust, like a REIT?
What's fascinating here is the complete removal of the corporate middleman.
Okay.
When you buy a REIT, you are buying a stock in a company that owns buildings. That company has a board of directors, corporate debt, management salaries, and just tons of operational bloat.
So they take their cut first.
A huge cut.
Yeah.
Your returns are heavily diluted by their overhead. But with tokenized real estate, the blockchain removes that corporate layer entirely. You are buying a direct fractional share of the physical concrete and steel.
So the rental income flows directly to the token holders, proportional to their share, without a corporate board taking a massive chunk of it first.
Exactly. Plus, you capture the pure appreciation of the asset itself. And the friction to enter this market has essentially dropped to zero.
Which is wild.
The analysis highlights platforms like Osol Gamma, which are acting as this perfect middle ground solution. They vet and manage the global income generation properties, but they offer fractional ownership through tokenization.
The entry point they note is what literally stopped me in my tracks. It's 500 SAR, 500 Saudi rials.
That's incredible.
That fundamentally rewrites the rules of who gets to build wealth. You're taking an asset class historically gatekept for ultra high net worth individuals and making it as accessible as buying a new pair of shoes.
And because the ownership is recorded on an immutable blockchain, it's transparent, it's instantly verifiable, and crucially, it's far more liquid than a physical house.
Right, because you can trade the tokens.
Yes. If you need your capital back, you don't have to wait 6 months to find a buyer for a whole building. You just sell your digital tokens on a secondary market.
Okay, so tokenized real estate gives us this stable, tech-enabled, highly accessible anchor. But an anchor just keeps you from drifting. It doesn't propel you forward.
True.
A 500 SAR fractional share in a stable building is a great foundation, but it's not going to double your net worth overnight. For that, we really need a growth engine.
And to build that engine, we have to look at equities. But the data shows a massive warning sign flashing over the most popular equity market in the world right now.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because the default advice for the last 15 years has been to blindly pour money into the U.S. stock market, specifically the S&P 500.
By the index, right?
Exactly. But the data essentially calls the current U.S. large cap market a house of cards. It's incredibly top heavy.
It all comes down to concentration risk. The headline numbers for the U.S. indices look fantastic, but those gains are heavily skewed by just a tiny handful of massive tech monopolies.
The Magnificent Seven.
Yeah, exactly. If you strip away the top five or six companies, the actual performance of the remaining 490-something companies in the S&P 500 has been relatively flat.
So your quote-unquote diversified index fund is actually just a highly concentrated bet on a few tech CEOs. If they stumble or face regulatory crackdowns, your entire growth engine stalls out.
Which is exactly why capital is aggressively flowing outward right now. We are seeing the MSCI World ex-USA Index, which tracks global mid- and large-cap companies outside the United States, outperforming the S&P 500 year-to-date.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Investors are realizing the valuations of the U.S. are stretched way too thin, and they are hunting for untaxed potential in emerging markets.
The data points specifically to Brazil, India, and Poland. Now, I get India, massive population, tech boom, but Poland is a fascinating standout to me. What are the mechanics driving a boom in Polish equities?
It's basically a textbook combination of favorable demographics and predictable monetary policy.
Mm-hmm.
Poland has a young, highly educated, growing middle class.
So lots of domestic consumption.
Exactly. That drives consumption. At the same time, their central bank has maintained incredibly stable policies.
Which is rare lately.
Very rare.
Yeah.
And when a central bank keeps interest rates predictable, massive foreign tech and manufacturing companies feel safe building factories and headquarters there because they know exactly what their debt will cost 5 years down the line.
Ah, that makes sense.
That influx of foreign direct investment just totally juices the local stock market.
But the strategy isn't just about throwing a dart at a map of Europe or South America. You pair these geographic shifts with thematic sector-specific ETFs. And I love the mechanical metaphor for ETFs here.
Let's hear it.
Think of a sector-specific ETF not as trying to pick the fastest horse in a race, but basically buying a fractional share of the racetrack itself.
That captures the strategy perfectly.
Yeah.
You don't need to know if Google, Microsoft, or some stealth startup we haven't even heard of yet will win the artificial intelligence arms race.
Right.
You just buy an AI ETF, ensuring you own a piece of the underlying infrastructure they all have to rely on.
The major sectors identified for long-term capital flow are healthcare innovation, AI, green energy, and cybersecurity. And honestly, the logic is unavoidable.
It really is.
We have an aging global population guaranteeing healthcare demand and a massive digital transition that mandates both AI expansion and the cybersecurity walls needed to protect it.
By blending those future-facing sectors with the untapped geographic growth of places like India or Poland, you build a really robust growth engine, one that doesn't rely entirely on the mood of the U.S. tech sector.
But let's introduce some reality here. 2025 is volatile. We've built a great growth engine with global equities, but emerging markets and tech sectors are highly sensitive to geopolitical shocks.
Very sensitive.
If global inflation spikes again or a supply chain collapses, that engine stalls hard. So how do you build a shock absorber for a portfolio like that?
You transition into the shield assets. The safe havens and income generators designed to protect your wealth from inflation and panic. And the most historically proven shield is, of course, gold.
I've always viewed gold as a bit of an archaic investment, almost like doomsday prep for finance guys.
A lot of people do.
But the data shows central banks, especially in emerging markets, are hoarding gold at record levels right now.
Yep.
If the institutions that literally print the fiat money are aggressively trading it in for physical gold, it kind of implies they don't even trust their own currencies.
It's the ultimate hedge against currency devaluation. Central banks aren't buying gold, expecting it to double in value and generate immense wealth.
Right. It's not a growth play.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're buying it to ensure that if their currency takes a massive hit, their national reserves hold a universally recognized baseline of value. It's wealth preservation in its absolute purest form.
So if gold is the mattress we safely stuff our money under to hide it from inflation, industrial metals are the raw fuel actually powering the next industrial revolution.
Great way to look at it. While gold is a static psychological hedge, the surge in silver, copper, and lithium is driven by pure, unavoidable physical demand.
Because of the green transition.
Yes. The global transition to green energy is incredibly metal intensive. You physically cannot build a solar panel array without silver and copper. You cannot manufacture an electric vehicle battery without lithium.
It's the ultimate pick and shovel play. During a gold rush, you don't bet on the miners, you sell them the shovels.
Precisely.
You don't have to guess which car company will dominate the EV market in 2030. You just own the lithium that every single one of them desperately needs to keep their assembly lines running.
We are also seeing a rapid rise in agricultural ETFs, which operate on a much more sobering mechanic.
Yeah, this part was intense.
It is. As climate conditions become increasingly erratic, global crop yields become far less predictable.
Right. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, a drought in South America or unexpected flooding in Asia isn't just an environmental issue. It's an immediate shock to the global food supply chain.
Absolutely.
That scarcity drives up the value of agricultural commodities. So investing in an ag ETF is a mechanical way of hedging against the financial impacts of climate change. If food prices spike at the grocery store, your portfolio absorbs that shock because your agricultural holdings increase in value.
That covers capital preservation and hedging. But a true shield also needs to generate stable cash flow without relying on the stock market.
Right. Income.
Exactly. Because interest rates have remained elevated, traditional fixed income like government and corporate bonds are suddenly offering yields we haven't seen in over a decade. You can actually get a meaningful return just by holding a bond, entirely free from the wild volatility of equities or crypto.
But the fixed income landscape has evolved too, hasn't it? The data highlights a massive surge in Sukuk, which are Sharia-compliant bonds.
Yes, huge surge.
And they're gaining heavy traction far beyond the Middle East, reaching deep into Asian and European markets. For listeners who haven't encountered them, the mechanics of a Sukuk are vastly different from a traditional U.S. Treasury bond.
They really are. Traditional bonds operate on debt and interest. You lend a corporation or a government money, and they promise to pay you back your principal plus a fixed percentage of interest.
Pretty standard.
But under Islamic financial principles, generating money purely from money like charging interest is not permitted.
So how does a regular investor actually generate a return then?
Well, a sukuk is asset-backed rather than debt-backed. When you buy a sukuk, you are actually purchasing a partial, tangible ownership interest in an underlying asset or a specific project.
Like what?
Say, a new toll bridge or a massive solar farm. The return you receive is an arbitrary interest. It's a share of the actual profit or rental income generated by that physical bridge or solar farm.
Oh, wow. So instead of holding a government's IOU, you own a sliver of the actual infrastructure.
Exactly.
That naturally appeals to a massive demographic of ethical investors who want absolute transparency about where their money is going and how it's being used to generate returns.
And it provides that essential, stable cash flow to balance out the aggressive growth of your tech ETFs.
Right.
It all comes back to synthesis. The most crucial takeaway from analyzing all these 2025 market dynamics is that a well-constructed portfolio never blindly follows a single trend.
Never.
The strategy is in the blending. You use tokenized real estate to establish your inflation-resistant anchor. You leverage global ETFs in places like Poland and India for your growth engine. And you deploy commodities and sukuk as your ethical stable shield.
So what does this all mean? It means the excuses are gone. The financial landscape of 2025 has entirely dismantled the old barriers to entry.
Completely.
Whether you have 500 SAR to drop into a fractional real estate platform like Osul Gamma, or you have 5 million to strategically deploy across green energy ETFs and physical copper, the tools are sitting right in front of you.
They're more accessible than ever.
You have the agency to audit your own goals and build a machine that works for your specific life.
The maps have been redrawn. The tools have been completely upgraded, and the execution is more accessible than at any point in financial history.
Before we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with a final thought to chew on.
Oh, this should be good.
We've talked extensively today about how drastically investing has mutated in just the last 10 years, moving from clunky, illiquid physical properties to seamless digital tokens trading on a blockchain.
It's been a wild ride.
Right. But if we are already fractionalizing concrete skyscrapers and fine art today, what completely abstract or deeply personal assets might we be trading by 2035?
Well, the technological infrastructure is already there to tokenize virtually anything that holds value.
Could we eventually see the tokenization of human potential?
Wow.
Imagine a world where instead of taking out a crushing student loan, A brilliant young engineer issues digital tokens representing a percentage of their future career earnings.
That is mind-bending.
You could literally buy fractional shares in an individual's success or tokenize entire community networks. It sounds like a dystopian sci-fi novel right now, but honestly, a decade ago, so did buying a fraction of a Saudi logistics hub from a smartphone while waiting for your morning coffee.
Very true.
It's something to keep in the back of your mind as the lines between physical value, digital ownership, and human capital continue to blur.